First, I want to thank council and parties for letting us adjust the time this morning. We did that to accommodate a commissioner's court matter relevant to the court. So anyways, we appreciate that. We have one case on the 8:30 docket and one case on the 9 o'clock docket. We will go from one directly to the next. Then we will take a break before the 9:30 docket to accommodate a change in panel. First case is Catalanato versus Metter Oldsmobile. Rose, if you'll please announce counsel.
May it please the court, Mr. Chris Medlinger will argue for the appellant, and Timothy Shabani will argue for the athlete.
Thank you. Mr. Medlinger.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a severance case. In this case, the appellee Metter Oldsmobile, Inc. made a verbal severance offer to all its employees. The actual phrase was all employees of Metter Oldsmobile, Inc. About 9 weeks after making that severance offer, it laid off almost all of its employees, gave severance to all of them except the plaintiff, the appellant, who happened to be the general manager. The people who worked there, there was a corporate officer, Taylor Gandy, and they were not employees.
Why not?
They didn't consider themselves employees. They weren't paid as employees.
Your whole point is we can't go to subjective thinking of Mr. Gandy. So I'm asking you, why was he not an employee if he worked there? Is that your pitch?
Well, he didn't work there, I guess, but that's what I'd say. He and Max Spiller acted as the president and stepped in the shoes of the president whenever he became ill and ran the business as the executors of the trust.
Mr. Mender, an employee?
I would say that as a president, he was the employee.
So he was entitled to the severance funds?
If he had survived to that time, he would have theoretically been an employee and survived, and yes.
So there was no one that worked there that was not an employee under your scope?
As it was considered, as it was developed, as it was implemented, we're using for purposes of this appeal, in the light most favorable to the defendant, even they admit that the plaintiff, Victor Catalano, was an employee and met all the terms of the severance offer. The fact that Mr. Gandy and Max Spiller, they didn't show up for work, they were in a supervisory capacity running the strategic vision.
Unlike the general manager,
that's right. The general manager showed up every day.
The general manager in a supervisory position over all of the employees?
I would say there's a big difference. Those people are showing up once a month and once every other month, according to their testimony, to give direction and strategic vision, saying, yes, what are the reports showing? What are the financials showing? Those types of things.
I have a question. Under tab 1 of appellant's first brief,
yes.
There is a document dated February 21st, 2003. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
And it says that we will pay you a bonus of $150,000 payable in a lump sum upon cessation of operations by the dealership. Is that not severance?
No, Your Honor. This contract was drafted and implemented as 2 years before a severance plan was ever thought of, conceived, or devised. What happened when this Metterold is General Motors has
So after the severance pay issue came up, then he wants to switch to the severance pay as opposed to the $150,000 severance?
No, this, Your Honor, under the February 21, 2003 plan that you're pointing out, he was owed this as a part of his regular compensation package. As Oldsmobiles, they started selling fewer and fewer Oldsmobiles, this policy was implemented to do two things. And it was never intended to pay him a severance pay. What that is a retention bonus, which is very different from a severance pay.
Well,
retention detention when it stops operating?
When this policy was implemented, the intent was, as according to their testimony, was to move all the employees, including the plaintiff, over to a new dealership, and they were pursuing doing that. They had a new letter of to open a Dodge dealership. They had purchased that land, and their intent was to move all, whenever they could no longer sell Oldsmobiles, was to move all of those employees, including plaintiff, over and start selling Metter Dodges or Metter Cadillacs, whatever the new dealership was going to be. So the purpose of this was to run this company as long as possible, make money as long as possible, and until they could convert and get a new dealership going, selling a different brand of cars.
Well, until the end of the dealership, he gets some money. If he stays to the end, and if he carries out the policies of the company, as we may determine from time to time, unless he's discharged, which is exactly the severance package that's going to be given to the other employees. I don't see how you... And it doesn't say anything about retention. It says a bonus payable in lump sum upon cessation of operations. So it's a cessation of operations lump sum or bonus, which is what all the other employees are getting.
Under this, you're right. This terminology never mentioned severance. It does mention bonus. It does not mention retention. Under their description of this policy, they give one purpose, one reason for this policy, one reason for this bonus, and that is to retain him until the operation ceased.
So now we're going to subjective.
No, that's their testimony. Again, we're in light most favorable to the appellee.
Andy's testimony that he didn't intend to give it to this fellow, give it to your client as basically another severance package.
Right. He did not, and he never expressed that to the plaintiff. He admits that, hey, that was always my understanding, my belief, but no, nobody ever told the plaintiff that. And the black letter law is the unexpressed subjective intent is not what's important. It is the manifested intent and the actions taken at the time the contract was formed. So under here, you've got... There's very little difference. The only similarity between the two bonuses is the fact that they say that both were to retain employees. One, the severance at the end was to retain those employees for the last 9 weeks, and that's where the similarity ends. There's the severance.
If they did something that caused them to be terminated, they did anything.
Correct.
It was like here.
As far as the purposes, what I mean is the reasons and the purposes for the severance. The similarity is the retention. One's based on a formula awarding length of service and pay. The severance is also to distribute the goodwill of the company. It's to reward long-term employees. It's to help because of the lack of notice to the employees that they're not going to help transition to new employment. The retention bonus has nothing to do with that. That's to help. We're going to sell less cars. You have been receiving bonuses in your entire salary. His salary is about $1,000 a month plus bonuses.
But under that scenario, wouldn't the 2004 severance memo or offer have to have been a modification to the 2003 letter agreement with your client?
Not only does it not have to be, but they agree that they're two separate agreements separated by 2 years, that one does not cancel the other out. Just like all the other employees, they have a compensation agreement. They're paid. In fact, most of the employees have something similar to this, with the exception of the retention bonus. They're paid a salary. They're paid bonuses. If you sell a used car, it's this much. If you sell a new car, you're going to get a bonus of this much. The testimony, all the evidence is that all the other employees received all their pay, all of their bonuses, and then also were eligible for severance pay.
How does it impact your client by virtue of the fact that the memo was never actually distributed to anybody, including your client?
I don't think the analysis is exactly the same whether this is a verbal contract or a written contract. It's still the subjective intent of a party is not what matters. It's what is expressed at the time of the contract formation. Under all the severance cases, it's exactly the same. They say, "Look, the continuing employment."
You're already covered by your first severance package.
When you're and you're covered, you're also receiving consideration in the form of whether it's an hourly raise or salary or whatever. But your continued employment under the new policy or under the new contract is what is consideration. There doesn't have to be some added extra consideration. The fact that you've continued working under the new policy, under the new pay plan, including severance or including retention pay or including both, is consideration itself. I think you have a follow-up question on that, but I'm not sure. Did I not address that? Whenever in our briefing, I think we made it very clear that the unexpressed intent, the only thing that Metter Olds did to say that this was not evidence at the time of contract formation was his unexpressed intent. In their briefing, what they countered with was Max's computation sheet and two or three things, all of which occurred or were drafted, existed, long after the contract formed. Given that, we'd say that there is absolutely no evidence to indicate that my client should not receive severance pay. All the evidence, as a matter of law, is that he was an employee of the company, they've admitted the same, and he's eligible to receive the severance pay.
So it was a unilateral offer, right?
Yes.
And that was given verbally by your client to the employees?
Correct.
So he didn't verbally give himself an offer, did he?
The offer would have extended from, and did extend, from Taylor Gandy and Max Spiller to, and they said it's for all employees and for the purposes I just mentioned. And now it's time for you to go out and tell all the employees. He told most of the employees. Greta Spiller told the office employees as the office manager.
Well, so
and she was also received severance, okay, even though she was one of the people who designated to go out and tell them.
So did she include Mr. Catalanato in the group when she went and told the office people?
The office, what I mean by office staff is the administrative staff, the secretaries, the payroll. And so, no, she was telling those group who she was over, okay, and he told all the other employees. And, in fact, she did receive severance pay, and she received her other bonuses. She received bonuses based on income and net income and such things.
Now, were you trial counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I don't want to say you,
it was me.
The complaint here is that you don't like the question that the jury answered, and you don't like the way the jury answered it, but you answered the question, and you allowed the evidence, which was the basis of your answer, into evidence. So how could you come back now and say, I don't like their answer to the question when I asked for the question and I allowed the evidence in?
And you're right. We've tried to make that very clear in the briefing and everywhere else that we did not object to the evidence coming in. And what I would point out is even if this evidence comes in, it does not, since it's subjective intent that was unexpressed, it constitutes no evidence. It is no evidence as far as proving that the plaintiff should have known he was not eligible when he was told that all employees, he heard the same information that all the other employees. All employees are going to receive the severance. They interpreted that one way for all the other employees and a different way for him. Excuse me, I'm sorry. And if there are no more questions, I'll reserve my time.
Thank you, Mr. Medlenko.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chovanec.
May it please the court, my name is Tim Chovanec, and I represent Metter Oldsmobile, who I'll refer to as Metter, the appellee in this case. I think that the last point that Mr. Calinato's counsel made is the key launch point for your consideration, and that is, let's assume, contrary to Justice McCoy's question, that somehow the evidence of Taylor Gandy's subjective intent is off the table. even though it's unobjected to. There is still a wealth of evidence in the record supporting the jury's finding to the formation question. First and foremost, the memo itself is unsigned. And as our brief points out, the lack of signatures, although not in every instance fatal, is evidence of ambiguity. Was this the final contract? Even Mr. Catalanotto admits this was not a final document because he made a proposal to change the memo. He said, we need a just cause provision in that memorandum. No subsequent memo was issued. No clarification was issued, but that indicates in Mr. Catalanotto's mind that this was not yet a final document. In addition, the severance chart, which although it wasn't created for about 3 or 4 weeks after the memo itself, the severance chart was created in December of 2004 and basically listed the individuals who would be receiving money under the November memo. Mr. Catalanotto's name was on that severance chart, but his information was struck through and there was no indication of any amount of money that he would be receiving under that severance chart.
Did the testimony verify who created that chart or how it was created?
Your Honor, yes. Max Spiller, the accountant for Medder, created that pursuant to Mr. Gandy's request to say, hey, we're going to implement this severance plan pursuant to the memo. Please calculate the amounts. And it's not like Mr. Catalanotto admits receiving it. In fact, he made a complaint on behalf of Mr. Courtney that Mr. Courtney's amount that was listed wasn't sufficient in terms of amount. So he was fully capable of complaining about there being an error on the severance chart. He never complained about himself receiving zero, but he did complain about Mr. Courtney receiving too little under the severance chart.
How did we get to this extraneous evidence of he helped formulate the whole severance package? He was aware that he wasn't going to be a part of it because he already had a severance package, and that's evidenced by the chart that shows his name through it. How do we get to all that unless we decide the word employee is ambiguous? Otherwise, we're looking at this.
Because it's a formation case. Most of the cases that you see discussing issues of ambiguity are signed contracts. The parties agree that there's a contract there. They just disagree about what particular verbiage means. We are talking about the essence of whether or not there's a contract that's been formed at all. That's a principal distinction. Plus, as the court has noted, Mr. Catalanotto had a pre-existing severance plan. And that provides the context for this memorandum. That is evidence of what was intended in this memo, irregardless of what Mr. Gandy may have thought.
But it walks like a duck and so forth and so on. And it walks like a duck because y'all paid all the employees everything under the contract that you're now saying, well, maybe it really wasn't a contract, but you acted like it's a contract and you paid all the other employees.
Everybody on the severance memo got a check that was recited to get a check. Mr. Catalanotto was not recited to get a check. That indicates the intent of the parties independent of Mr. Gandy's subjective feelings at trial. It is objective, an objective indicia of a lack of a meeting of the mind.
Excuse me. It doesn't indicate that he's not to get a check. There's a specific notation that means do not release check, and that is not by Mr. Catalanotto's name. There's just no amount. But it doesn't say specifically he's not to get a check. That is Spiller and Edwards and Courtney and Stillwell that are not to get checks.
Your Honor, that's our interpretation is different and divergent from the court's. The strike-through of Mr. Catalanotto's information it means, and the absence of any dollar figure to the side is indicative that Mr. Catalanotto is not even to be contemplated under the document.
And we know that how, since it's not his name that's struck through, only the amounts, as though they're in error. How are we or Mr. or anybody else to know that he's not to be considered? Because there are people whose names are drawn through with X's by their names.
There are multiple ways of interpreting the document, Your Honor. But to contend that it constitutes no evidence to support the jury's finding on lack of intent or lack of formation is a different thing. If the jury had construed it differently and answered yes, your point would be well taken, but the jury answered no. In addition, the jury heard testimony that Mr. Catalano never complained about the absence of a dollar figure there, whereas he did complain about the absence of a dollar figure or a high enough dollar figure with regard to Mr. Courtney. And in the context of the pre-existing February 2003 severance agreement, that makes sense. Look at it this way. In February of 2003, Mr. Catalano signed an agreement which paid him $150,000 for the remaining 11 months of the year, $150,000 for the entirety of 2004, and at the end of 2004, another $150,000 as a severance payment at the cessation of the company's business. That's almost $500,000 in less than a two-year period. In addition, Mr. Catalano received a bequest from Mr. Medders' estate. So he received $500,000 from the Medders, and I can see at that point why he would not have approached someone with regard to the severance chart and said, hey, I want another $150,000. If he thought that he was entitled to that.
All right, let's back it. Here's the memo. You're saying that this case is not about, here's a contract, the question is, who's an employee? We say it's ambiguous. We want to go outside the contract and decide who's involved. You say that's not what this is about. You're saying that this is a formation case about whether only his client is a part of this contract. Because you can't deny that this isn't a contract to everybody else because you acted like it was a contract. You paid everybody else. So for everybody else except his client, this is a valid contract. That's what you're saying so far. Now, how do you take this and say, well, the employees here didn't mean his client. It meant everybody else. How do we get outside of this paper, even saying it's a formation case, to go to extraneous parole evidence or whatever if employees isn't ambiguous? How do we, even a formation case?
Well, Your Honor, I think employees is ambiguous, all employees, as we point out in the brief, and Mr. Gandy testified at trial.
But I thought the customary, this isn't a case about this is a contract and employees is ambiguous and we're going to go outside and see who's an employee. You said it's not about an existing contract. You said it's a formation case about whether a contract was formed with his client and then.
I'm not sure I understand. Our position, Medders' position in this case, is that no contract was formed with Mr. Catalinato.
Only. The contract was formed with everybody else because you treated this like it was a contract, even if it wasn't disseminated to them because you followed the terms and conditions.
And the severance chart shows that. That's why it's such a key piece of evidence.
So what you're saying is this contract covers everybody but him, his client. And what I'm asking you is, are you saying this is a valid contract, but the word employee is ambiguous, and so that allows us to go outside of what this says? Or are you saying a contract was never formed between his client and yours? And my question to you is, under either case, how do we get there unless employee is ambiguous? And if you say it is ambiguous, it seems to me the evidence that you're talking about that constitutes an ambiguity is subsequent to the formation of this contract, as he points out.
If you don't have a pre-existing severance agreement, that provides the context for the issue of ambiguity. Employee, in Mr. Gandy's testimony, meant non-managerial employees. Why did it mean that? Because my manager already has a severance agreement. I'm taking care of him, as the court pointed out. There is no consideration for the subsequent promise. He has already promised to remain until the cessation of business, and he's going to receive $150,000 for that. There is no consideration for paying him to stay until the cessation of business under the November memo.
So the bottom line is, your contention is that employees is ambiguous because it means non-managerial, because that's what he meant. And his contention is, it says employees and it means employee, and his client was an employee. That's the point of contention.
I think so, and as you know, we cite a definition in the dictionary. That makes that distinction. In my mind, that's a distinction that I've held my entire life. Mr. Gandy testified that that's a distinction that he admitted candidly at trial. This could have been a better written memo.
Yeah.
It's not perfect, but his intention and the word employee and his testimony with that, in addition to the context of the pre-existing severance agreement, was sufficient evidence in the minds of a reasonable juror to give credence to the idea that there was no meeting of the minds. There's other evidence, not the least of which is Mr. Catalanano's admission at trial that there was no meeting of the minds.
Well, you know, and I know that the jury probably thought ain't fair. That's why they answered the question like this.
Well, again, he'd already received $500,000. Well, again, I don't think this court would project itself into the jury box. What we have is the jury's answer, and we have evidence that's not been objected to in the record. And the testimony from Mr. Catalanato was the question, there was no meeting of your mind and his as to whether or not you were going to get paid severance under that plan, was there? Answer, my name specifically, no. Again, that evidence is in the record. It's unobjected to and will support the jury's finding of no formation of the contract. There's other indications in the record supporting Metter's position in this case. In addition to the evidence, in addition to the failure to complain about himself, but to complain about Courtney, or to complain about his failure to receive sufficient funds under the Hiles dealership agreement. That was a used car dealership where he said, look, I'm entitled to more than this. Mr. Gandy said, no, you're not. Mr. Catalanato, being in the car business, I don't think was a shrinking violet. I think he was fully capable of protecting himself in instances where he thought he had a protectable interest. Yet he was silent. And what did Mr. Catalanato do at trial? There was no pleading in the case that this was an unambiguous contract. There was no motion for summary judgment in the record that this was an unambiguous contract. There was no motion for directed verdict that this was an unambiguous contract.
You need to plead unambiguous. I'm having trouble with that word. You need to plead ambiguity. He doesn't need to plead a lack of ambiguity, I don't believe.
Your Honor, the issue of ambiguity can be tried by consent. In that regard, by the way, there's a citation that I failed. Your Honor, yeah, that's correct. The Sage Street case, which was inadvertently omitted from the brief, 863 Southwest 2nd, 438 at 444, talks in great detail about the ability of parties to try issues by consent when you have competing evidence admitted. And the last thing that Mr. Catalanato did at trial was, as pointed out by the court, in their proposed jury charge, said, let's submit the formation question to the folks on the jury. Let's ask them if we had a meeting of the minds.
His counter-argument is we didn't try it by consent. And if, even if we did try it by consent, there's still no evidence of ambiguity. He's saying, yeah, well, I let all this evidence in, but it didn't constitute any evidence of ambiguity.
I believe that was limited, and I believe my time is out, but I believe that was limited to the issue of Mr. Gandy's subjective intent. As we indicated, an unsigned contract where there's no complaint about a simultaneously created severance chart is substantial evidence in addition to his admission that there was no meeting of the minds. For these reasons, we would respectfully pray that this court uphold the jury's verdict and the trial court's actions in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Shafonik. Mr. Medlenko. And will you address whether everybody concedes that this was presented as a verbal offer? So in that scenario, doesn't extrinsic evidence have to come in to prove up what the verbal offer was?
Yes, I guess. I don't know whether it's extrinsic evidence. It's evidence as to what it is, not evidence as to what was unexpressed at the time. This is what was said. Let's assume it was just verbal. This is what was said. Here's how it happened, and here's what happened. What they're trying to say is, and by the way, we had our fingers crossed, or I was thinking this. I don't think there was any intent to deceive. I don't mean to suggest that. But we didn't express this, but we also want to add this, even though that wasn't a part of those negotiations or part of the offer. I want to make one point clear with regard to this whole draft issue or whether it's verbal. There's, again, we're the severance offer in the light most favorable to Meadow-Olds. They agree that the whether it's verbal or whether it's written, it was basically tried at court as though this was the agreement because everybody agreed, including the appellee, that this accurately and exactly set out the contract and the offer as it was made, as it was intended to be made, and was made. The only reason it remained a draft and wasn't distributed is because my client said, look, we need to put in there the just cause thing. So with that one exception, they admit, and that just provides the something to look at, the reason that this is identical. Mr. Gandy, all of their witnesses agree that this written memo is identical. I want to point out, there's no evidence that this was later modified or changed or withdrawn, which that would get into later potential extrinsic evidence. Hey, we changed that. That's not what they're saying. They're not saying we changed it. They're saying it was the same. It stayed the same all the way throughout. But maybe if the plaintiff had seen this Maxis computation sheet, that should have given him some indication at a later date that we didn't intend to include him, which, again, that's not contemporaneous evidence. The only contemporaneous evidence that I've seen as to the formation of the contract is within the four corners. Even Mr. Gandy, in his testimony, it's pointed out in the briefing, said, look, nothing in either of these agreements cancels the other one out. So Mr. Shafonik just said, hey, the evidence of the pre-existing, what he calls severance agreement, the pre-existing retention bonus is evidence maybe that he of what he could have been thinking later. I just dismiss that. I don't think that is credible.
Or else it's an ovation.
And I'm not sure
The 2004 offer is an offer to change the terms of the 2003 agreement, so it's an ovation.
And if that were the case, but that's not what they testified to. They said that these are two separate agreements, separated by 2 years in time, not having anything to do with one another, and that nothing, their testimony, their position, nothing in one cancels out anything in the other. Well, that's just, it's not a trade. If you want to go back to the facts of the case, what this was set out a minimum. His pay, actually, with all his bonuses, was much more. This set it at the minimum, the low end. So even with the retention bonus, as was pointed out at trial, over the span of the time once this became enacted, what it did was they wanted to backload his pay to incentivize him to stay. He was fine with that. Instead of being paid $180,000, something in that range, the testimony was $150,000 to $180,000 normally. Instead of being paid at the high end, he's paid at the low end but gets the money at the end of the cessation of operations. I want to also point out that these payments are due at separate times. The retention bonus would have been due December 31st, 2004, at the cessation of operations. The severance pay is due, based on a formula, when you're told that your services are no longer rendered. Again, there was no intent to tell him his services were no longer needed. The point was, hey, we're going to get this other deal going, and you're going to help us, and you're going to run this new dealership. But we want you to be sure and stay around until then, because if we don't pay you, change your compensation agreement, then why would you stay? Because you're going to end up making no money or at least that was the thought. They ended up making pretty good money all the way up to the very end by selling more used cars and doing other things. A little while back.
Okay.
I'd like to do that.
Not an order, that's a suggestion.
My morning is clear. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Medlenko.
Thank
you, Mr. Shavonik. We appreciate your arguments and your briefing, all very nicely done and helpful to the court.
Thank you.
Your case is submitted and you all are excused.